From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. On October 30th of 1787, readers of the New York Packet newspaper found details of ships anchored in the harbor, advertisements for dried cod and molasses, and notice of a reward for the return of a chestnut-colored mare, along with something else, the new Constitution of the United States.
As summer faded to fall, the free people of the United States, finding the Constitution folded into their newspapers and almanacs, were asked to decide whether or not to ratify it, even as they went about baling hay, milling corn, tanning leather, singing hymns, and letting out the seams on last year's winter coats for mothers and fathers grown fatter, and letting down the hems for children grown taller. They read this strange, intricate document, and they debated its plan.
That is Harvard American history professor, historian, and The New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore reading from her new book, These Truths, A History of the United States. And those debates have carried on ever since. Those everyday details distinguish Lepore's account of the Republic from 1492 to the Trump presidency. She presents the ideas of political equality, natural rights, and the sovereignty of the people that gave rise to the Republic, along with accounts and events which question whether the country has lived up to them. And she's joining us now from a studio at Harvard. Jill Lepore, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, also in that issue of the New York Packet, a much more abhorrent notice: to be sold, a likely young Negro wench and her small child. When you're doing a history of this scope, you have to choose which stories to tell. So how does this one, that detail, illustrate your choices?
Well, I got this story from teaching the ratification debates of the Constitution, where to try to help bring alive to undergraduates who need a little bit of prompting to be engaged and interested in the American past, I would print out a facsimile of this issue of the New York Packet from October 30th of 1787. It's just four tabloid-style pages. And I wouldn't tell them what it was, and I'd just pass out this newspaper as if they were reading the newspaper. And I would read it, and they would page through it, and they would look around, and they would be drawn to the Federalist Number 1, the first essay of the Federalist Papers that appeared in that issue of the newspaper. And it's a very powerful, stirring essay by Alexander Hamilton. But they were always completely distracted by these everyday details, which was sort of the point, right? That you'd be having your breakfast in 1787, and you'd read Federalist 1, and you'd also be trying to figure out whether you'd seen this wandering horse around town,
right,
or whether you were interested in getting a good deal on cod down at the docks. And then just the everyday atrocity of slavery, just ever, like alongside everything else in that paper where you were asked to debate about the Constitution. I sensed as a teacher how effective this was to transport students to a world that is very familiar in some ways, but also entirely alien, and jolting you a little bit out of your complacency and see the doubleness of that world, right? Both the magnificence, the extraordinary political ingenuity of the experiment that is the founding of the Republic and the writing of the Constitution, and the idea that the people get to decide whether or not to ratify it. Like, this is a government the people get to ratify. And then also the way in which the people are not ratifying this document at all, that hundreds of thousands of people are being held in chattel slavery.
Yeah, the dualistic notion of freedom, who was entitled to it, is really baked into the very origins of the country, which you began in 1492. Columbus landing and declaring that he'd take possession of this new world in the name of the Spanish crown. Was that characteristic of the age of discovery?
No. So I start there actually just because it's an extraordinarily important date. And for many Americans, it seems obvious that American history begins on that date. And for many Americans, it seems utterly morally objectionable to even think about that date as an important date in history. So I begin with, in the heat of that controversy that comes down to us in our own day, right? The kind of controversy over Columbus and the celebration of Columbus, or Columbus as a figure in American history. And one of the things that I'm trying to there to help readers to understand is how very strange is what Columbus did, was that going to a new place and declaring that his king and queen owned it, which is not what Marco Polo did or other explorers from the earlier years and centuries did. So what was going on for Columbus? What is it about this taking of possession? Where does that come from? And what does the centuries of resistance of native peoples to the European slaughter and enslavement mean? What does it teach Europeans about the nature of rule? So really the way the book works is to the first half of it is really trying to explain the origins of these truths, these three ideas of political equality, natural rights, and the sovereignty of the people. Like, where did those ideas even come from? And I argue that they come from all the peoples who are denied those things and who keep asking, especially enslaved people who keep running away and staging rebellions and saying, by what right have you taken my life, my labor, my liberty? And this fuels a lot of political philosophy in Europe. The debate over whether the conquest was morally defensible, something that just tortured the Spanish court, and they proceeded anyway, and our acknowledgement needs to be of the great cost and the great suffering and anguish that that decision cost. But it's important to think about what ideas that sparked.
Well, and it's also interesting to me, I'm not a student of history, but how connected America's formative ideas were to the geopolitics of the time, the growing colonies of the Caribbean, and how much the worldview on the islands, their fear of slave rebellions, how that kind of codified political oppression here in the U.S., and it would eventually follow. So from the outset, was the U.S. defining itself as distinct from the rest of the world?
Insofar as it was taking literally the philosophical argument that there exists in historical time a state of nature before the existence of government, by which writers like John Locke, the 17th century English political philosopher, meant men, which men agree to form a government to protect their property and their happiness and stability, that there could be such a time was really largely a thought experiment of 17th century philosophers that itself was born out of the experience of observing native peoples, right? And the sort of fiction, the supposition that native peoples had no government. But for Americans, the degree to which they understood themselves as distinct in 1776, say, and especially in 1787, was this isn't just a thought experiment. We are now in a society where we have no government. This after, you know, declaring independence, we have no government. We have to create one, and then we have to bring it to the people and ask for the people's consent. And this hadn't happened anywhere before. This is the particular popular ratification of a whole frame of government. Americans did understand as distinct, but not in the sort of triumphant American exceptionalism, almost sort of like sacred, worshipful way that in some parts of the United States later became. In fact, they understood that as an extremely fragile experiment, as a very tenuous and vulnerable political condition to be in, one that they hoped that they would survive. But the experimental nature of it was forefront in their minds, not that it represented a remarkable victory and triumph.
I want to pull out a little thread that you just presented there, the laws of nature. The new nation was born not by accident and force, but by reason and choice. So a secular nation based on observable fact, and even from the beginning, we hold these truths, was at first followed by to be sacred and undeniable. Those are the words of Thomas Jefferson, which Benjamin Franklin, he edited out and said to be self-evident. What did that change mean for the new republic?
So the men who drafted those documents lived in the most secular age in American history, either before or since. You know, the earlier decades of British mainland settlement involved very strict church and state arrangement, and many of the New England colonies were essentially theocracies, for instance. And the early 19th century would witness a tremendously impassioned evangelical revival. But Franklin and Jefferson in the 1770s and 1780s, when they were writing these founding documents, church membership was at historic lows, and those particular men were deists who were very committed to the secular rational thought of the Enlightenment and to a government that operated as a political experiment, like any other experiment that could be conducted in a laboratory, and that therefore, to be good politicians, i.e. good scientists, they had to study other people's laboratory notebooks, and that's why they read history in Madison as well. I mean, these people were unbelievably dedicated students of history because all the histories of all previous peoples and governments were a set of experiments to be learned from. And so in designing this new republic, they wanted to be fully informed about what would be the right ingredients for this run of the experiment. And that is the spirit in which the nation was founded and in which the citizenry is asked to participate. We think of the United States, of course, as founded on political equality, and so deeply and profoundly it is, but it is also founded on a spirit of inquiry, that it is our obligation as citizens to inquire into the truth of matters so that we can cast a good ballot, so that we can choose the ablest person to represent us, so that we can make the most informed and clear-headed and fair-minded and public-interested decision with regard to a political issue. We shouldn't make those decisions based on persuasion or corruption. We need to make those decisions based on rational inquiry, using reflection and choice, as Hamilton said. That's the ideal behind the whole spirit of the endeavor.
My guest is Jill Lepore. She's author of several books of history covering topics from the Tea Party to Wonder Woman. Her newest is A History of the United States, and it's called These Truths. Equality was the idea here, but of course, there were two different existences. There was a rebellion against the crown based on this idea of individual liberty for one kind of person, the European person, and the other suppressed African. So for all of this soaring rhetoric of inquiry and moving forward, did they fail? Was this republic rooted in that failure?
One thing I think is important to remember is that the colonies, the mainland colonies, were moving pretty quickly towards the abolition of slavery during what comes to be called the American Revolution. And what holds them back is trying to form a union to declare independence from England. The northern and middle colonies have to hold on to the southern colonies, in particular South Carolina and Georgia. And South Carolina and Georgia, where African slaves vastly outnumber the white planter population, have a lot more in common with the British island colonies, Jamaica, Antigua, Barbados, which have a very similar economic and demographic structure. And the Caribbean islands don't want to join the American Union. Like, among other things, they do not want to kick the British army out of the islands. They need the British army to defend them against slave rebellion. It's New Englanders. Like, Boston is an occupied city after the dumping of the tea, even by 1768, after the Stamp Act and other forms of political resistance in Boston lead the king to send over two regiments of the British army. So the Northerners want to get rid of the British army, and they also want to emancipate their slaves and have an end to slavery. And the Southerners really agree with the Caribbean Islanders, that is to say the British planters in the Caribbean Islands, who want to keep the British army around to protect them against slave rebellion. And they really want to be part of that economic system. So the compromise that Northerners and the middle colonies make is to not abolish slavery immediately, as England does in the 1770s, and instead sort of throw their fate in with South Carolina and Georgia.
We have these two different American existences and two Washingtons. You tell the story of not just George Washington in detail, but Harry. He was a slave who had escaped from Mount Vernon. What became of him? He retreated to the British.
Yeah, so slavery has been abolished in England by 1772, essentially. And yet, in the colonies, or in the new United States, slavery continues to exist. So one way that the British recruit troops when the rebellion begins is by promising freedom to any slave who will join the British army. Lord Dunmore in Virginia offers this declaration. And at the time, George Washington hears from his cousin at Mount Vernon that many of the slaves on the plantation are likely to run away. And he, you know, his cousin writes to him, "Liberty is sweet." I mean, the rhetoric of liberty is not unfamiliar to people who are living in that household. So Harry Washington, who had been born in Gambia and had been kidnapped as a young boy and ended up working in the stables at Mount Vernon, eventually does flee. He escapes to behind the British lines. So there's incredibly grueling stories of women who are pregnant trying to get behind British lines because they can get a certificate for their baby, the certificate of freedom. And Harry Washington is among those of Washington's slaves who escape. He evacuates with the British when they evacuate New York City in 1781, and he ends up a settler first in Nova Scotia, and then he goes back to an English colony in Africa where he wages a rebellion and is known himself as a revolutionary. And, you know, we might say, well, should we spend so much time thinking about Harry Washington? Well, historians have done an incredible amount of detective work to uncover the story of his life. That's not my detective work, the work that incredible archivists and archival historians have done, because we have for too long failed to pay attention to. I mean, if you think about the rhetorical claim of the Black Lives Matter movement, Black Lives Matter historically, too. And what our history has previously looked like is that we have a kind of segregated history. We do know the history of the presidents from George Washington all the way down to Donald Trump. And we have separately, like in a different column, a history of social movements, a history of slavery and Jim Crow and civil rights, say, or a history of women's rights and suffrage and temperance and the Stop ERA movement. But there, as if those happen in a different world, or a different lane or a different column. In a textbook, they're often in a sidebar. But when you think about George and Harry Washington and you watch their stories unravel together, and know how well they knew one another, it helps us restore the lived reality of people at the time.
That's Jill LaPorte. She's author of These Truths. It's an epic volume of American history, and we're going to dig into some of the people who lived out the ideas that that history was founded on when our conversation continues. I'm Virginia Prescott with On Second Thought, an historian and Harvard professor of American history, Jill LaPorte. She's author of several books, most recently A History of the United States called These Truths. It doesn't claim to be the whole kit and caboodle, but it is, at 932 pages, a comprehensive account of the Republic, which declared political equality, natural rights, and the sovereignty of the people to be self-evident truths. And it covers a history of the nation, which leaves the reader to decide whether the country has lived up to their ideals and where it's fallen short. So I'm going to just push forward, as you had to do in many places in this book, and look at after the Revolution, staggering population growth, a staggering acquisition of land, the emergence of the Free Soilers Party, the Democratic Party, other parties in the 19th century, and the question of who was allowed to vote. But first, given the season that we're in, that process of voting itself, people had to bring their own paper with them, with their ballots. How did this work?
Oh, I love this story. I have to say, when I went and researched the history of how people vote, it just knocked me out. I mean, it actually cast so many problems into such sharp relief. The idea that we vote secretly, most importantly, is very late in American history. It really doesn't emerge at all, even as a possibility, until the 1850s. So before then, voting is a public act. It's the obligation of a citizen in a republic. And to attempt to hide how you vote, or, God forbid, to not vote, is an incredibly shameful act of cowardice. So early on, voting is done. You kind of just go to the town square, and like all in favor of Smith, go to the south side of the square, and all in favor of Jones, go to the north side of the square, and we'll just count heads. That's what's called counting polls. A poll is actually the top of your head.
Oh.
So when we say counting polls, we're actually talking about counting the tops of people's heads. And then that was a bit of a pain. So people had the idea of what they would use, bullets or ballots. Ballot means a small ball, comes from the Italian, and has the same root as the word bullet. And in New England, where there was a lot of corn and a lot of beans, there'd be a box and you'd throw in a piece of yellow corn for Smith and a black bean for Jones. And then it would be pretty easy for the ballot counters to just sort out those two different colors. But again, you'd walk up and you'd, publicly drop this in a ballot box. It would be not a hidden thing. It became a little bit cumbersome when people had the idea of using scraps of paper for this. And then you had to write down the name of a candidate that you wanted to vote for. And literacy rates were quite low. So when parties were formed, the first sort of fully elaborated party system in the 1820s, and when the expansion of the suffrage came about so that all white men, including the abjectly poor, for the first time anywhere in the history of the world, men who couldn't read, men who couldn't write, men who paid no taxes, men who had no jobs, men who had only just arrived in the country, men who did not speak English, everybody could vote if you were a white man. It's an extraordinary time. But how the parties get those people to vote is they print ballots in the newspaper. And the one party will print one color ballot and one party will print another color ballot. And you just tear out the ballot. And it's a big, colorful sheet of paper with a list of everybody that you want to vote for. And you walk through the polls and you try not to get beaten up by people from the other party. And everybody's drinking. And people do get beat up. There's no election before 1896 in the United States where someone isn't killed at the polls. And so it's not until the 1850s that someone that has the idea in Massachusetts, what if we could give people an envelope to put their ballots in so people couldn't see what color they are? And Massachusetts passes that act, and then it's repealed. 2 years later, so people just think that's ridiculous. That's so cowardly. So even when people are killed on election day and they try to, you know, claim that there's been voter intimidation, the legal standard is, could a man of ordinary courage have voted, which is it's an interesting standard. So it's not until after the Civil War that the idea of a secret ballot becomes popular, and it is adopted. Although initially in Massachusetts, it's most widely and quickly adopted in the Reconstruction South. And it's actually adopted, the secret ballot. That is a ballot that is printed by the government and supplied by the government to voters, which they then cast in a secret place, usually behind a curtain. Every way that we vote today comes from that 1880s innovation. And it is largely adopted in the former Confederacy to disenfranchise black men who have been enfranchised after the Civil War. And now, as part of a whole set of schemes, poll taxing, literacy tests, the secret ballot is used to disenfranchise black men because there's a literacy requirement to it. It defends a literacy requirement.
It is startling to see how much of American history was formed by those distinctions of race. In the decade after the Revolution, 1 million enslaved people were brought here. And we see the advent of the Electoral College based on population, which counted enslaved people as three-fifths of a person. That was used to assign delegates and congressional representation. So we begin to see this shift and the triumph of the North over the South in electing Jefferson and later Andrew Jackson. There's this seesawing that's continually going on between the power of the North and the South. Was that all about slavery?
Slavery was a chief driver for that, and I think it's a grim story in many, many ways, but there's also something just so inspiring about revisiting the words of orators in particular who are challenging that system. I mean, the thing that really stirs me from that era is a sort of conversion that Frederick Douglass has. Frederick Douglass is born into slavery and escapes in 1838 when he's 20 years old, and he goes on to become this incredibly powerful speaker and writer. And for a long time, he takes the abolitionist position that the Constitution is irredeemable because of the Three-Fifths Compromise and because of the way it sanctions slavery. And so he gives a lot of speeches, you know, attacking the Constitution and attacking the hypocrisy of the founders and of Jefferson in particular, and with particular new kind of political chaos and violence in the 1850s, he changes his mind. He changes his mind and he says, look, if we actually want to end slavery and we want to build a political order that is fair and equitable, we need to use the Constitution on our side. We actually can't be trying to dismantle the founding document of the country that has brought such freedom to so many and more than in anywhere else in the world. And he becomes a constitutionalist. And that rhetoric and the way that he writes about and speaks about the Constitution, you see it replicated in the speeches of Abraham Lincoln in the debates of 1858. And, you know, Douglass wants to say, you know, well, the founding documents tell us that the country was founded by white men for their benefit and their posterity forever. And Lincoln says, look, where? Where is that? Where is that in the founding documents? You know, abolitionists like Frederick Douglass tell us there is a promise of equality for all souls that comes for Douglass and other black abolitionists from Christianity and from the spiritual equality of all people. So as much as you can look at that era and see the brutality of the extension of slavery and the degree to which, especially its extension to the West, that puts pressure on the balance between slave states and free states. So you could see all that horror, but you can also see the incredible courage and beauty.
My guest is Jill Lepore. She's author of several books of history covering topics from the Tea Party to Wonder Woman. And her latest is A History of the United States, and it's called These Truths. I'm glad you brought up Frederick Douglass, because I didn't know until reading this book that he was the most photographed man of the 19th century. And there's this emergence of technology throughout the 19th century and beyond that countered this kind of Jeffersonian image of the salt of the earth farmer toiling away on his own steam. And there is a whole section on the machine, how you divide the book up, that begins after World War II. But I'd love to look at that 19th century belief that technology could just save everything. Samuel Morse believed that the telegraph would bring about world peace. And Frederick Douglass, for him, it was the photograph. So how did he use, in addition to his rhetoric, this new medium?
Yeah, the whole very idea of progress was really undergoing a profound transformation in the 19th century. The idea of progress, say, in the 17th century is a purely theological one. It was the Christian progress from sin to salvation, you know, the pilgrim's progress. In the 18th century with the Enlightenment, progress becomes secularized, but it is actually about the moral progress of all people toward a better and better world, that sort of Panglossian, and every day it's getting better and better in every way. And in the 19th century, progress becomes a kind of technological idea that each new machine will fix all of our problems. It'll fix problems of scarcity. It'll fix problems of division. It'll fix problems of inequality. And so for Morse, just as you say, the telegraph is the solution not only to conflict between nation states, but to divisions across the United States. It will hold the country together like so much twine. And for Frederick Douglass, this is something quite beautiful and stirring. Walt Whitman has the same idea about photography, that it's a democratic art. Before photography, people didn't see their own likeness. Poor people, middle-income people, only the very wealthy had a portrait painted. And so to be able to see your own likeness and see other people represented was to sort of enter the common humanity of men. It was a fundamentally democratizing art. Even the least well-paid servant girl, Douglass said, could have a portrait of herself and could carry it around. And in particular, that black men and women who had been represented as racial caricatures, as racist caricatures by white artists, could see themselves represented and could show themselves to the world in their full humanity. And also as well that slavery could be exposed, that photographers could capture the brutality of slavery. And think about the continuity of that tradition. I mean, for Black Lives Matter, Periscope broadcasting and sort of live streaming from Facebook, body cams, cell phone camera footage. Actually, it's the exposure of things that have been unseen by others that has been a very significant part of emancipation efforts here and around the world. So Douglass isn't entirely wrong about that, but his, like Morse's, belief, kind of unquestioning belief in the capacity of a technology to solve political problems, survives also down to our day. And that belief, that just uncritical technological utopianism, is just generally wrong. I mean, I think you could see it, for instance, with the internet, and most of us remember the hype in the 1990s about digital democracy and how the internet was going to solve all kinds of problems of political cohesion. That had happened before.
Yeah, and we've seen these kind of movements of saviorism in different forms. And another character that ties into this book is Maria Stuart. She is one of those who participate in this Great Awakening, this religious revival led largely by women, which seeded a number of later movements, strengthened the abolitionist movement, certainly temperance, the women's rights. So what mark did that movement have on the role of religion in the U.S.?
Well, I think it's important to understand that while the sort of new rights claim that the United States was founded as a Christian nation is just not empirically demonstrable, the fact that Christian evangelicals have been active, especially as political reformers in American history from the very start, is absolutely true. Going back to, you know, the debate, the Spanish Franciscan friars who objected to the conquest and objected to it as Christians, there's been an extraordinary continuity of devout Christian believers entering the political realm to fight for the common humanity and equality of all souls in the eyes of God, and therefore in the realm of the public sphere. And Maria Stuart is part of that tradition. She was a free black woman who lived most of her life in Boston and who worked essentially as a lay preacher. She wrote for The Liberator, the great abolitionist newspaper, and she also preached. She was the first woman in the United States to speak before what was called a mixed mixed audience, an audience of men and women. It was completely impolitic for a woman. It was unheard of for a woman to speak before an audience that had men in it. And she did that for a number of years, but she was finally sort of shut up from doing that. But one of the things that Stewart's story recovers for us is the importance of evangelical Christianity to our political traditions and our political style, but also reminds us, I think, that long before women gained the right to vote and long before black women were able to exercise, women don't gain the right to vote legally until 1920, and black women don't gain the right to exercise it in practical terms until 1965 because of Jim Crow and because of voter intimidation and suppression in the South. For all those years when women are not voting, when it's not even remotely conceivable that they could vote, they exercise an influence over politics largely through moral suasion. And it's an extremely important force in American politics. It creates a whole political style, the moral crusade. And that, too, is with us still. I mean, if you think about Me Too, it emerges from the failure of the law to fully accommodate, to fully recognize harms against women, even though there are statutes, there are, you know, laws to prevent sexual harassment, to prosecute sexual assault and sexual violence, they haven't been fully enough executed, and women have engaged in a moral crusade yet again. But it comes out of a very, 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 very long tradition.
Yeah, and this is one of those shifts and that has created things that are stamped in how we think about the country today or how it's developed, certainly. Another big shift is from the agrarian life to the industrial. And you write about the first large-scale factory. This was built in Lowell, Massachusetts, and it was proposed as an alternative to these harsh conditions of the English and Scottish factories. What is it that made the United States a place to experiment, to reform?
Well, I think some of that experimentation is a particular American brand of capitalism, and it is one that is extremely forgiving of risk-taking. Speculation is rewarded culturally in the United States in quite a different way, and we forget, for instance, I mean, if you spent any time reading the novels of Charles Dickens, which are written chiefly in the 1840s and 1850s, every other character is thrown in debtor's prison, kind of rots away in debtor's prison. Debtor's prison was if you fell into debt and couldn't pay your creditors could put you in prison, which seems silly to us because how can you ever earn enough money to get your way out of prison when you're in prison? But the idea was that your relatives would get you out. Debtor's prison has been abolished in the United States long before Dickens is writing his tales. And even before debtor's prison is abolished, Americans are availing themselves of bankruptcy protection. In other parts of the world, bankruptcy protection is only for bankers. It's really only for the wealthiest people who are actively conducting stock brokers and bankers. In the United States, bankruptcy protection is extended to everyone. And that those two things, the abolition of debtors' prisons and the democratization of bankruptcy protection, means that when Americans take financial risks and they lose everything, they have a capacity to start again, which means that Americans take more risks. I mean, there are more bankruptcies, and there are a lot of failures. There's a lot of misery involving booms and busts, and before the economic sort of wild cycling of the economic system is to some degree reined in. So there's a lot of financial suffering as well. But what you see is this extraordinary amount of risk-taking.
That is Jill Lepore. She's the author of These Truths. It's the history of America. And we're going to dig into more after a short break. I'm Virginia Prescott with On Second Thought. My guest is Harvard professor of American history, Jill Lepore. She's an author, most recently of These Truths, A History of the United States. You may also know her from The New Yorker, where she's a staff writer and has written hundreds of, I'll call them micro-histories in that magazine, vivid details of people and events from the past and little pieces of history made of those whose speeches were never recorded or lives not followed or monuments were never built for. African Americans, Native Americans, women, homosexuals, groups usually consigned to the sidebars in textbooks. Well, they're all included in These Truths, her new history of America. It is, in her words, a civics book. It's not seeking blame, but a view of America through the promises made in the Constitution and whether we've kept them. So, Jill Lepore, you do begin the book with an epigraph from Abraham Lincoln. We must disenthrall ourselves and we shall save our country. What does that mean to you?
Among the things that Lincoln was talking about was his, just to use the word polarized to talk about the Confederacy and the Union is a really quite radical understatement. But what Lincoln is trying to talk about is the degree to which politics can be a form of enthrallment, which is to say we lose sight of what's real and what's not real. We kind of put blinders on as we engage in this brutal, by any means necessary battle in which we see our countrymen and countrywomen as our political enemies, not just as partisan opponents, and that the only way to save the country, as he saw it, was to pull away from that and to understand what we share and to celebrate what it is that we share and to struggle toward what we in common aspire for. And that's the spirit in which I tried to write the book and the spirit that I think American public culture really needs right now. It's extraordinary to me how artfully we have manufactured a machine that automates that enthrallment. We live in a very polarized world, and that polarized political divide was built manually in the 1970s and 1980s and even into the 1990s by political candidates and political consultants and by office holders who had short-term gains in mind by widening a political divide between liberals and conservatives. And at the end of that era, the internet was open to commercial traffic, and soon thereafter, social media began, and that polarization is now no longer even done manually. It's just automated. Hmm. I think it's extremely difficult to figure out how to get out of that.
Well, you have such a regard for debate. There's a lot of time spent on the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and I'm embarrassed to admit that I actually didn't know he lost that election. Lincoln lost that election. But 12,000 people attended their first debate in Ottawa, Illinois. And you look back through the history and the profits of having great debate. But still, that debate ended in blood, if you really look at it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So do you look at it back at a time when political arguments were regarded as more gentlemanly conversation? Have they completely turned into blood sport?
The really important difference to mark between the 1850s and our day is who the we is. I mean, the debate between Lincoln and Douglas is a debate between two Illinois aspirants for the office of U.S. senator. And the people attending those debates are almost all white men, right? This is a public space. This is a public debate. There's a lot of people there. They are the franchised. We think now of who constitutes the electorate, and it is everybody who is an adult and who is a citizen. It's a much broader debate. And so it can be easy to say, well, things were different then, and these were more gentlemanly debates, and they were having these civil conversations. Objectively, that's simply not true. They were beating each other up a lot as well. And then, of course, the war comes. But it's also the case that it's quite a narrow group of people who are even eligible to participate in debate. Hmm. And what's harder for us, and we need to note that and accept that that is harder, is having a debate with a much bigger political community. And I don't mean numerically. I mean in terms of actual diversity of the political community to which we all belong. And that's why we need to have a better and more inclusive and more expansive and more generous historical vantage in which Harry Washington is an ancestor of yours and mine, and so is George Washington an ancestor of yours and mine, that we have a common ancestry. We have to, I think, fight for that and insist on that if we can have a common future together.
Well, a lot of people say that we are still fighting the Civil War. Are we?
No, we're really not still. I just don't think we really are fighting the Civil War. The political alignments are completely different. There's some, you know, weird holdovers. If you look at an electoral map from, you know, recent presidential election and the kind of blue state, red state divide, that even the particular way of coloring states by virtue of their political affiliation. That comes from the 1850s. It becomes a map maker convention. It actually is part of what is spurring people to war, is needing to conceive of the country that way, picturing the country that way, in which the free states are one color and the slave states are another color. And it looks a lot like our contemporary red state, blue state divide. There's just no two ways about it. There are similarities between those regional differences and ours. But I think one thing to think about, I was talking to someone in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, a couple of weeks ago, and I was doing a book lecture, and she had just come back from a canoeing trip, a week-long canoeing trip that had been extremely rugged. She's like, oh, I was so proud. You know, we had to get up so early, and the portages were so long, and it was so cold. It was really high up in the mountain. Just some group thing she had signed up for online. And over the course of a week spent with all the other people who were on this canoeing trip, they realized that they were all from the same latitude, you know, all the way across to Montana. And, you know, it just became a kind of joke within the group. Like, I guess we are the hardy people at this, you know, like a plant zone hardiness, you know, at this line of latitude. We're the people who will get up at 5 a.m. to carry the canoe for 4 miles through the woods. And it was something to me so beautiful about picturing the country as divided up by lines of latitude instead of by state boundaries and which country would, you know, which county or which state went for Trump and which went for Clinton in 2016. A lot of what we think of as the rhetoric of the Civil War is still with us is a construction of people who are making a lot of money off of selling that idea, off of stirring up, riling up the electorate, getting people to hate one another more so that they will go out to vote. I think we should be really thinking about what it means to be a person who's making money off of that. And I think we should be more overtly critical of the industries that engage in that kind of essentially political incitement.
The gaze of the historian is one thing and what you decide to focus on, but also the gaze of the person who's reading it. So in the case of like the Dred Scott case, this is 1857, almost universally regarded as one of the worst Supreme Court decisions ever. But the justice who wrote the opinion said something like, Congress had no power to limit slavery in the states because those who wrote the Constitution believed Negroes to be inferior. So I can imagine somebody like a white supremacist cherry picking that and saying, ah, see, this is what the Supreme Court said about the Constitution. Those who wrote the Constitution believed themselves to be superior to black people. Isn't all of this filtered through the opinion of whoever is reading it?
Oh, we absolutely do that. But that is part of that work of being a citizen, is actually engaging in that debate. I mean, I write in the book, this isn't exactly what I say, but some, you know, a nation born in contradiction will forever fight over the meaning of its history. And that is, you know, when you take your kid on a long trip and you're trying to get somewhere and it's going to be great when you get there and you do have a great time and then you go home, but then you actually realize it was the traveling together that was what mattered most. Mm. It wasn't that you spent time, you know, in the, you know, on the islands off South Carolina and had a saw some beautiful beaches. It was actually what you said to one another and how you shared meals together and some person that you met in a hotel lobby who told you something about her life that spoke to you as a fellow human being. And it's the journey that matters. And in this case, it's not the winning the argument. It's actually having the argument and having a decent argument, having an argument in which we accept that we are actually here together. And that is different from no holds barred by any means necessary political battle, which is where we're at now.
Is there a particular way to your mind that the country has not lived up to the declarations in the Constitution, something that sticks out for you?
Oh, gosh, yeah, there's a whole lot.
There are so many characters here.
You know, there's this beautiful speech that Thurgood Marshall gives in 1987 when he's asked to speak on the occasion of the bicentennial of the Constitution. And he says, I'm not going to celebrate the writing of the Constitution. Like, it was a problem of a document. I'm going to celebrate the 200 years ever since where people have fought to realize its promise. And that is the spirit in which I write and think. For me, though, to answer your question specifically, the failure to ever actually ratify the Equal Rights Amendment and therefore codify the equality under the law of men and women is a political settlement that the country urgently needed at the time and still needs.
Yeah, and this is character of Phyllis Schlafly, a name that many people may know, but she leads the defeat of the ERA, and she was dismissed early on by some politicos as a crank. You point to her as someone who really seized the Republican Party and became the architect of the modern conservative movement.
Yeah, I really think she's underappreciated as the architect of the modern conservative movement, which in many respects is a moral crusade, is in many respects a female crusade. It's not surprising to me that so many white women voted for Trump, that so many white women came down on a different side of other people on the sort of Kavanaugh, Blasey Ford Supreme Court public debate in any case. Schlafly has been underappreciated because women's historians don't tend to pay a lot of attention to the history of the conservative movement, and because conservative historians don't pay a lot of attention to the history of women. She kind of just falls between two stools. But she was very active in the Republican Party beginning in the 1950s, you know, a housewife and a mother of six, but also a Radcliffe graduate who put herself through law school in order to defeat the ERA. She was a McCarthy, very strong and important supporter of McCarthy in the 1950s, incredibly important to Barry Goldwater's moral Christian crusade in 1964, where he won the Republican nomination. She's forced out in many ways of the party in the 1960s, and she claws her way back in order to fight the ERA after it passes Congress and goes to the states for ratification in 1972 and really transforms the Republican Party.
We talk now about bitter divisions, pugnacious politics, you know, norms being subverted. And you're presenting a history that shows us that we've been here before in some respects. Is that the message, that the Republic survives, you know, on that journey, on that car trip, wherever you're going, nonetheless?
I wish it were. I do actually think there are distinctive features to our political unease that are of a different magnitude of concern than in other moments. I do think the automation of polarization is a fairly intractable problem. I think the profiteering of people who are selling hate is a pretty difficult problem, because we have no spirit of reform. We have a lot of rhetoric right now about resistance, or a lot of rhetoric about revolution, or think of the Tea Party's rhetoric of revolution, say, or on the hard left, the hashtag resistance movement. We have very little public discourse about reform, and yet we have a number of institutions that are so desperately crying out for reform. So I find history a solace, because there's so much misery in the past that sort of the present, obviously there's a lot to be hopeful about, but I don't actually feel that the study of the past ever relieves us of the obligation to assert ourselves to make the present and the future better.
Is there a time in history that you look at and think, oh, I would have liked to have been alive then?
No, because nor would any woman of reproductive age thinking about the fetal monitor. Is something I would not have wanted to live in an age before the fetal monitor. Just in terms of my own history as a woman giving birth, I spent a lot of time interviewing Tea Party people who said, I wish I lived in the 1780s. Oh, my God. You would be burying all your children and then dying of malaria. Like, no. There's nothing, there's no age that I'm interested in returning to.
You do close the book with a Niebuhr quote, but it also, when I was reading it, made me think of another one, Reinhold Niebuhr. Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary. Is there any sort of, you know, this is human nature. Are we even governable as people in this big union that began in 1492? I guess you might make that case. And then 1776 and now.
That is in some ways both a deep philosophical and epistemological question, and also a religious question, right? It's a question about the moral capacity of humankind. It is a question that a lot of people have debated. We're not going to settle it in the last few minutes of this incredibly fun hour, but thank you for putting that to your listeners, because they can sit at the dinner table and wrestle that out.
Okay, so the vulnerability of the Republic that began with such vulnerability, that has gone through so many permutations. Are you looking at this now and thinking, you know, history writing so quickly, are you already seeing things that you're going to be revising in your next revision?
People ask me that all the time, and so far things don't seem very different to me than they were in 2016 when I ended the book on Election Day 2016. So far I don't feel that it is in need of an update, but time will surely require one.
So how did you decide when to stop?
I had initially planned to stop on Inauguration Day 2009 with Barack Obama's inauguration. Historians do not like to try to explain the recent past. We don't have enough vantage on it to explain it to any standard of satisfaction with our given our methods as the way that you work as a historian, the way that you think about the past, a certain amount of time has to have passed. So 2009 seemed okay. It was like almost 10 years ago now. And then it also is a kind of great ending. Just whether you voted for Barack Obama or voted against him, it's a great ending to a long story. A beautiful scene, dramatic moment, stirring speech. And then Donald Trump was elected, and I thought it just would be professional negligence not to try to explain that election in some way, that it would somehow be a betrayal of people that had voted for Trump or people who had strenuously opposed Trump, to just not even attempt to reckon with it.
So sounds like a little bit of wariness about this moment that we're living in, but a whole lot of reasons to find beauty, not just in the past, but in the present.
Yeah, I guess I do find that that's probably more dispositional than professional, but I'm a more of a hopeful person than a hopeful historian.
Well, Jill Lepore, what a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was great to talk to you.
Jill Lepore's new book is called These Truths, A History of the United States. There's more on the book at gpbnews.org. And that is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Our engineer is Alex Word, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.